could turn now to Ahmed Soliman, who's asking, his question is, given the political tensions we've seen over repeated electoral cycles, a more viable long-term solution to the electoral system is needed under the next dispensation. Do you see avenues for achieving this through political dialogue and consensus building following the elections?
It depends on who will win the next election, you know, who will come to power. If that person more focuses in how they come back, you know, how they stay in power, will most likely Somalia, the experience we have, other Somalis will try to overthrow that person by force. So it depends on who will come and the strategy they will have. Later on, Ruqayya mentioned earlier about the duration. You know, a duration, time is not going to change anything unless the person who is at the top of the policy come up with a good strategy. At that time says that, okay, time is short. So this is what I have achieved so far. So how can we go next and add me extra time? Maybe the term of the president, make it 7 years or 5 years, what we have seen. But what we most likely in Somalia, we have incompetent politicians coming by clan, because we have certain clans, you know, they only that clan become a president, they win by chance, and then they get a support from, you know, countries, and they gain power, especially Banadir taxation. So that person will focus only to enjoy the privilege of being president and gaining money and staying in power. I want to comment earlier on the election, is it better to go from bottom to up? You know, at the moment, South Central Somalia, we have seen the local governance. There are some donor and the government trying to bring the federalization to district level. So we have seen Wajid Hudur making some elections, indirect election to elect their commissioner. But if you don't have taxation, the way Alia Omar mentioned, it's like who's very important for a community? Is it the school, a health, or electing someone? So we can go there. So if a district brings taxation, can organize, you know, and manifest themselves, then we can say the election, we can start from bottom district level to federal, then we reach Mogadishu level. So always, if we only focus on donor money, you know, within someone who have a short-term political, you know, strategy, we will see reputation of each election time after 4 years discussing about, is it the violence? Is it going to happen? Are they going to accept the election outcome? So we need a strategy that's, yeah, and owned by the, you know, citizens.
Thank you, Idil. And Ruqayya, I'm wondering, given your experience in development and justice issues, as well as gender issues, like what are your thoughts on whether there's any way to have some kind of political agreement, consensus on stopping a repetition of this sort of power-hungry, power-grabbing past that Somalia has experienced? Do you see dialogue, consensus building as a way of actually changing things, or will it just be hot air, people having workshops, having chats about this, meetings about it, but actually nothing will be achieved in terms of changing the reality on the ground?
I think one of the things that, one of the ways to combat this, there was a question that was asked in one panel that said, why are African leaders so power hungry or something like that? And the answer is they're not power hungry. We don't have systems in place and we don't have empowered citizenship, right? That's the difference. Anyone, anywhere would like to be in power forever, right? America even went into like a murky water with Donald Trump. So the idea is that what protects countries are institutions, strong institutions and systems that we need to be put in place. We cannot rely on the goodwill of a well-meaning politician in a fresh suit. What we need is we need to move away from this vicious cycle. We need to go to bring in the power to the people. And I know it's almost embarrassing to use these words like democratization, because it's been used for so long and so many donor money have come through this attempt to democratize Somalia. And we have no evidence on that. to this day, even the using the word election is embarrassing because there is no real election. So I think that the best way to go about it is not to pray and to wish that some kind of a meaningful politician will pop out of the blue. It is to create these systems and to move the country away from the 4.5 formula that was supposed to be temporarily put in place to resolve a country in an utter disaster war, but it was not supposed to be a permanent solution. And now it's becoming institutionalized to the point where forget presidents and ministers, even all the way down to director of departments are now being used this formula of 4.5. If you remove someone in a particular clan, someone has to come with the same clan. So I would, my thought is the pilot project and democratization process that's happening in Queensland from the bottom up can really show us something. We can learn lessons. And one of the things that I fear is people insisting in perfection, right? Abdel Nasser mentioned that 2012, Queensland was moving towards a democratic process. However, other clan politicians, candidates in other clans insisted that the system was not perfect enough, right? And that's the thing, democracy is messy. Democracy requires learning lessons. It requires dialogue. It requires people losing something, gaining something else. But it is something that can allow people to have, bringing power to the ordinary person. And so we have to be careful not to insist in perfection. Even now in Ufain, in Qarbro, in Ail, where these grassroots electoral model is happening, my fear is, I've already hearing the rhetoric in some of the social platforms, if you hear it, is saying things like, oh, this is not authentic, this is not perfect. And we have to be wary of that. Because if we keep saying if the democracy process is not perfect, we're just gonna stay with this one. I think we need to move away. Imagine if Queensland did have elections in 2012. That would have given us a decade of lesson learned, a decade of moving away from clan systems, a decade of allowing the bottom-up process to take roots. And so I think that systems, we need institutions, we need systems, and we need to move away from this vicious cycle.
But Rukia, in terms of this 4.5 model, whereby majority clans each have one part of four and then minority groups have the 0.5, if you eliminate that, even though it obviously is problematic, isn't there a kind of risk that this is going to mean that the powerful clans are going to completely dominate Somali politics, and it will mean that those weaker groups and the minorities will have even less power, that, or even if it's kind of cosmetic power, than they have now, and it'll end up being a little bit like the situation perhaps ended up for women in Somaliland this time around, where they have almost nothing in terms of political power, at least within the legislature.
Absolutely. The 4.5 system allows minority clans to gain seats that wouldn't have been possible. That's true. But I think one of the things that we've seen is, usually when changes happen, you know, there's that transitional change that's painful. But we need to put in place, you mentioned minorities in class, but even women, right? If we need to put in place process that allows protection of minority, protection of women. But if we think that this vicious cycle, this process have guaranteed or have helped elevate minority clans, it has not, you know. We have what they call token 0.5 gatekeepers. If you look at the formula today, the four main clans, their seats are very competitive. But if you look at the 0.5 clans, there's always the same individual that have been in power for 20 years. Matter of fact, I think this will allow, it will open up some room for other minorities to come in. Right now, I don't want to name names, but I can name the 20 people that sit in those seats, federal level, who've been there. Some of them have served, you know, the dictator presidency, and some of them have been in power in the past 30 years. So these are not really representation. They're just gatekeepers, and they have done that. They have not improved the lives of the minority. They have not improved these clans' service delivery. So for me, my benchmark, where I draw the line, is what has this formula done for these minorities? It has done nothing. So I think this will take a risk. Somaliland has taken a risk. They have hit a, it was embarrassing for as a woman, as a Somali woman, what have happened there. Su'ad Olad and major Somali land women that are well known have all lost seats, and it was shocking to us. But it also means that they have now drawing, they're going back to the drawing board, and they're now providing solutions, what they can do better in the next phase. And I think I'd rather take that solution than be stuck in this formula that has done nothing for my country.
And it was interesting in Somaliland that one candidate for parliament who got a huge number of votes was an individual called Bakad from the Gaboye minority clan. And so even though women were really kind of ignored, in some ways, this young man, he's quite young as well, Bakad, he's become something of an ambassador for minority groups to become a little bit more visible, I suppose, in Somaliland. So maybe he will serve as an inspiration for others. And we've got an interesting question now from Andrew Maina, which is about Dadaab in Kenya, basically saying that the government has, the Kenyan government has ordered the closure. Once again, it's done that before, of the camps in Dadaab, and that this will inevitably trigger the movement of Somali refugees into Somalia this year. And Andrew is wondering, like, will this have any effect, this possible movement of many hundreds of thousands of Somali refugees if they really do close the camp? Will that have an impact on the electoral process? Do any of the panelists, like, would any of you like to say something about that?
Yeah, I can jump in here, Mary. I think the starting point here is Kenya-Somalia relations rather than Dadaab itself. You know, I'd be very surprised if this camp is closed and closed on this schedule, regardless of whether that might be a long-term objective of Kenya. In the short term, you know, this is one of the pressure points Kenya can use on Somalia. We've seen this relationship, especially when it gets quite poor, that there's a lot of kind of tit-for-tat measures that go back and forth between Somalia and Kenya. And this threat to close Dadaab is one of those and kind of flood Somalia back with these refugees and whatnot. So I'd be surprised to see that. I think there's some wider issues in the Kenya-Somalia relationship, which have been exacerbated under the Farmajo administration, but also need to be resolved with after post-election as well, related to the border and security and kind of this buffer zone area, and also obviously related to the maritime dynamic. And I think, you know, if those if there's some sort of a working relationship to address those issues, I don't think you're going to be hearing so much about Dadaab. If there, you know, it gets a little heated again, then yes, I think you're going to hear about this quite a bit. So I wouldn't expect it with regards to this particular electoral process, especially given it's an indirect process anyway. You know, even if you have a lot of people flooding back in, they're not going to be voting. So I think it's more just one of these tit-for-tat measures, and then wouldn't expect it to have much more of an impact. It's more a reflection of where Kenya feels about Somalia and vice versa.
The issue of the Dadaab, just to add, become a political bargaining for Kenya. You know, whenever they feel that Somalia is not responding the way they want, they start the issue of the Dadaab. At the moment, Somalia government and the officials, they are not taking serious. This is the discussion when you look in Somalia. The discussion is not going around, but I think the next government, maybe one of the things they are going to think their foreign policy, it's like, how do they deal with the Dadaab issue? And I think it's that time, the Dadaab, even the Somalis who live in the Dadaab, those who live in Somalia see that it's the time to end this issue of, you know, the Dadaab. And every time Kenya is feeling that they're not in control of Somalia, bringing Somali refugees, I think it's something, not at the moment, it's not a threat, but maybe later on is what Somalia government needs to think.
Thank you, Idil. And maybe if you can also help us with this question. This is from Patrick Gathara, and he's saying, to what extent does the involvement of Somalia's neighbours in AMISOM help or harm the democratisation process? Would expediting an AMISOM pullout, which seems to be a goal, be helpful in light of the politicization and fragmentation of the Somali National Army? That is a very important question, Patrick. Thanks for asking it.
Exactly. I think the influence of AMISOM at the moment, when AMISOM is not just a one country, it's a group of countries especially. So like Kenya troops, they are in Jubaland and Ethiopia in Southwest, and also some Djiboutian troops in Hirshabelle, especially in Beledweyne. So I think at the moment, the discussion around it's like Ethiopia is busy its own internal issues. So they most likely won't have, a big influence the way they did Southwest elections when they were part of the, capturing of Robo. So at the moment, they don't have that power. They are busy internally. But one of the reasons I think Gedo people refused to have part of, Kismayo, to bring their seats in Kismayo was because of the fear of Kenyan troops in Kismayo. They may be used, to overtake their seats by force. So most likely this time they have to be careful how they assign themselves, their troops, the neighboring countries. It's not that much. But the question is, if AMISOM leaves now, what's next for Somalia? It will be a dilemma because the president is protected by AMISOM. When you look in Mogadishu, the airport is protected by AMISOM, the boat, the state house, everything. No one is taking or thinking what's next for Somalia. And now you have a Somali military based or selected. The way Ruqayya Aliya mentioned, everything is based on clan perspective. Now you have a general who came because of the clan X. This position was on this. And Somali government is not thinking what the next strategy for them. I think maybe there will be a disaster if AMISOM leaves, even the next government, it has to come a plan.
Thank you, Idil. Thanks very much. And Abdi Nasir, I'm wondering, in terms of Puntland, where you don't have such a kind of proliferation of international forces there, perhaps the Puntland security forces are not as fractured as some other parts of the Somali National Army. In terms of their involvement in the electoral process that's underway, how is that different from South Central Somalia, and how do you think, is it better, is it worse, is there anything the rest of Somalia can learn from the way that Puntland organises its security, perhaps especially around elections?
Thank you very much. This is a very important question. We can look at it from different angles. Besides Puntland, in general, Somalia or in Africa, the army is always sometimes problematic to democracy and the elections. And if the leader, the commander in chief, is not in support of that process, it can easily and possibly the army can intervene and manipulate or block opposition from the access. In Puntland, so far our president is a pioneer for this process. He is supporting. He is politically and financially injecting the process. Puntland has enough trained and equipped police and paramilitary that is sufficient enough to provide the security services that's needed in the election day and the election. Polling stations. We don't see or expect that much a problem in security so long the political leadership is in support of this process. The situation in Southern Central is not comparable and is completely different than that of Puntland, because we know and we see that the incumbent leadership now in Villa Somalia will actually make use of any chance or any possibility that he sees his and his team, political and military army team, can capitalize and manipulate the election. I have no doubt that the team now in Villa Somalia will use that as an opportunity. And we have already observed that in recent months that they wanted to rig the process and and manipulate it. Okay, if we have AMISOM now out of Somalia, especially Southern Central, what will happen? That's a very good question. And I think it will not be that much different from what's happening now in Afghanistan, because it is the African troops that's providing the security, that's providing access and the protection to humanitarian agencies and also protecting the main infrastructure and supply, you know, routes. So I don't see them leaving anytime soon from Somalia. And if that happens, I think it's going to be a nightmare that cannot imagine what will happen, and possibly everything will fall back down to the hands of the terrorist groups. So that's not an option, but it's up to the Somalis to get ready and, you know, get their, you know, homework done and start, you know, transferring responsibility from security responsibility from the AMISOM and other partners that's, you know, literally supporting the security. So yeah, that's my take.
Thank you, Abdi Nasir, and I can see both Rukia and Umar have some comments to make about the whole issue of AMISOM. So maybe Rukia first and then Umar.
I think in terms of the security sector, it's clear that I think sometimes I get really uncomfortable because we have to separate. When we're talking about the security advice, we're talking about leaderships. We're not talking about the ordinary Somali soldier who's sacrificing his or her life in the front line, paid very little, and it's contributing greatly to the Somali security. When we talk about the security apparatus and security, we're talking about that level that has always been politicized. In terms of what's happening in Puntland and Somali National Army in South Central Somalia, is that the process. There's high stakes in the South. So high stakes means that the leaderships are constantly shifting and changing. And that creates this immediate connection that if you don't serve the current administration, then you'll be debuted. You heard what happened with Sadiq John, who was the commander during the election deadlock and conflict, and many other things like Gurgur. There was a fear that Gurgur and Haramat was being utilized by the current administration. And so that is something that we need to look closely at, and we need to find a way to create a military apparatus that is independent and that can have continuity so that they don't shift and change depending on which administrations comes in. In terms of Puntland, Puntland has been a really great example of what does it mean to use a Somali-led security sector. However, if you talk to the ordinary Puntland soldier, they are underfunded. They're much more underfunded than most of the funding by the international goes towards the South Central Somalia. So it's...
Oh, Rukia, it's frozen. Okay. Yeah.
So let me just close it in there. I'm sure Omar has a much more interesting point to say about this, but for me, I just think that we have to kind of remember to kind of separate those two. When people say things like the Somali army it's corrupt, it's the elites, it's not the ordinary citizen in the front line serving this country.
Thank you, Rukia. And now Omar, if you have remarks, it would be great to hear from you as well.
Sure. Just a quick one on AMISOM. I mean, 2 points here. Yes, I mean, it's absolutely damaging to have frontline states involved in a peacekeeping mission. You know, that's kind of a cardinal rule of peacekeeping to avoid that because they do come in with their interests. And we've seen that happen with Kenya and Somalia and Ethiopia and Somalia as well. But I think if you take a wider view, I mean, part of AMISOM's mandate and role there is to provide the space for political processes to take root in Somalia. And they've done that twice with two previous elections. And, you know, without AMISOM being there, I don't think you have those elections. They're definitely not in Somalia. And so without them being there, you know, I think there's a lot of talk about their future and pull out, but without them being there, I don't think we're talking about an election right now either. So it's just, you know, I think that's unfortunately the reality there.
Thanks, Omar. And just to add to that, Idil, perhaps you can answer this. What do you see the impact, if any, on Donald Trump's decision to take the US, a lot of the US presence in Somalia out of the country. Do you think that that has had any impact on security or anything else to do with perhaps the electoral process, the political situation?
I think the American troops, most likely, they don't go, you know, in a fight in certain area. What they give is technical support to Somali military, you know, and they're very strategic, the areas they are. They train AMISOM, then AMISOM connects to Somali National Army. At the moment, it was not that big, you know, influence, the number they pull out, you know, but for them, the most important, the Americans in terms of military Somalia, they give is the funding. You know, they support much of the Somalia military system, even the security reforms, they support a lot. So that's what matters at the moment. And then when you look in terms of the security, they also did an amazing in terms of drone attacks. So much of the Al-Shabaab, they ran away, the big cities or the area they used to control, it was the kind of drone attacks. So what most likely for Somalia government at the moment and in the future for them is very important. It's like the technical support they give at high level military, the way they train like Alpha Group or Danan, you know, it's under the control of the Americans. What they do, it's like for the American militarization or training in Somalia is different than the Taki. For them, it's like they give the same quality or equipment to Somali troops. So these guys, usually they are the ones who go when there's you know, an attack in Al-Shabaab some areas. So sustainability of that kind of training is very important. And also the support of in terms of funding and all that, and the drone attacks. But for American military, for their presence, I think Somalia can at least go forward. But those other means are what's very important for them. And if I come back, the security, the number of, you know, foreign troops in Somalia, it doesn't matter if they have become 1,000 or 100. What matters is the quality and how do they put that quality back to Somali military? And how do we make sure that the Somali soldier feels that he belongs to Somali government, you know, not an individual? And what have we seen at the moment? It's like all the, you know, the high level of the security sector, they are friend to someone. You know, when that person leaves, they also leave the job. We have seen what happened, former prime minister's office, you know, who was handling the security reformation system in the country. So we need like security, military, those guys to make sure that they are not, you know, interfere or interact or have close relationship with administration. We need to separate those, you know, systems. That's what matters at the moment.
Thank you very much, Idil. And we've got another really interesting question here about census in terms of the Somali population and the makeup of the population. So it'd be interesting to hear from all of the panelists on this. This is from Jose Bendito, who's Chief Social Policy Officer at SCO. And his question is, how is the lack of a census limiting one person, one vote elections at federal and member state level? What should be the sequence of events after populations are known at district and member state level to move from the 4.5 formula to a more representative parliament? So basically, if it's ever possible to hold a proper census in Somalia, how would that impact on this current 4.5 model and help to move it on to something else? I don't know who would like to answer that first. Maybe Rukia?
I think it would create you know, we're operating now blindly. There is the National Bureau of Statistics are doing a household some kind of a statistical data for household, and that even it wasn't even a national population census, and that was even politicized. It was stopped, I think, in many states. They felt like the government was going to use this in the future to manipulate some data. So I think it's critical, it's important, and we need to, and this is where institutional building and kind of separating these political issues with what we need to do in terms of service and deliver is having these numbers. I think the UN, UNFPA has some preliminary data They have done a lot with the nomadic community, with the rural community. And I think, you know, each state's boost, you know, they start with like millions of people. So when you go to those areas, there's like barely 20,000 people there. And so we need to operate accurately. And I do agree that that was the first part. And the second part of the question, I'm sorry, Mary, you have to repeat it because the internet is horrendous.
Yeah, it was basically about, let me just get back to the question. Hold on a second. It was asking that, let's say once, if these figures were known, like what would be the sequence of events to move from the 4.5 formula to a more representative parliament? Like once we knew the figures.
Yeah, it's part of.
How would that maybe move away from the 4.5 and have something that's more honestly representative?
I think I think Abdelnasser may have actually a better answer than I do in this area. However, I do believe it's actually prerequisites to go through towards democratization. We need voter registration. We need accurate population numbers. Abdelnasser mentioned that the preliminary registration was 46,000 people registered, yes? And so, but then the question is, what is the actual population in that area? What does that mean in terms of percentage? All these things is necessary. So I do think that's something that, you know, it's putting the cart before the horse. We have to actually have those data available in order for us to go through a proper democratization process that is balanced and accurate. Abdelnasser, you can jump in.
Thanks, Abdi Nasir.
Please.
Yes, if you have
I would like to emphasize that the absence of a population census is I don't think is a condition for not moving away from the 4.5. There are so many issues or important. Assignment to be done to before census to move from using 4.5, but I also like to bring to your attention that recently when TPEC presented the number of the registers in these three districts, they used a figure that they have taken from the Ministry of Planning to show how many people registered from that and make the contrast to how many people was lastly estimated to have lived in that district. So the number they have used was put together with Somali Ministry of Planning and the Puntland Ministry of Planning. So it was not the part of their assignment, but they just used to show the contrast. And it has been a problematic, it created a problem that caused, the process to almost collapse. For instance, people in Ufine, were arguing that Ufine was estimated to have lived 50,000 and it was registered almost 10,000, whereas Ail was estimated to have lived 150,000. And was actually registered 11,000. So they were arguing if there is a politics and interest is involved in there. How can that difference exist in Ail and Ufain? So it's a problematic. But I don't think it is a condition for not having election and democracy. For instance, there is a time that Puntland wanted to have elections without even a registration. Now we are trying to have a registration. Somalia also have the same experience in the past. So I think and knowing the fact that Somali democratization and state building is in the making process, I think we should not expect to have everything in place, but to start whatever and means that's possible for us to do it and also to move away from using the clan-based system. And lastly, and most importantly, I think Puntland will need to have a census for one issue, which is the fact that there, the districts and the regions that's now in Puntland has multiplied we have more than 50 districts and more and 9 regions. And also the council, the size of the council is also, for instance, Gardo is more than 3 councillors are to be elected from Gardo, whereas Hargeisa is 17. So all these problems are waiting, you know, in Puntland. But I think there's still, again, here a lesson that we can learn from Somaliland, because they were using the regions, the seats of parliament of you know, for one region, were contested across the region. So I think we need to find a way to maneuver and find, you know, solutions, but I don't think it's a condition, you know, that we cannot do without having it.
But thank you, Abdi Nasir. So I'd just like to thank the panel and also the audience for your great questions. And I'd like to thank very much Rukia, Mohamed Botan, Idil Ibrahim, Abdi Nasir Yusuf, and Omar Mahmoud.
All right. Thank you all. Bye-bye.